trumpet. Had she swapped the one thing that was really hers, her music, for the chance to keep her family together?
We should go back, Lito said.
He wobbled to his feet.
We're not too far gone, and with Castro being so lenient right now, we won't be punished for leaving.
No, Lito, Isabel said.
No. As much as she feared the loss of her music, her soul, she wouldn't trade that for her family. She grabbed Lito and held him back.
Don't! We can't go back. They'll arrest Papi.
Panic rose like the distant rumble of thunder in Isabel's ears. But then Ivan and Lito both looked up like they could hear it too. It wasn't Isabel's fear that shook her deep down to the pit of her stomach. It was the enormous tanker headed right for them.
Mahmoud, Izmir, Turkey, 2015. 4 days from home. Mahmoud stood in a wet parking lot with his family, a light drizzle making everything slick and damp. Down past a pebbly brown beach, the Mediterranean Sea churned like a washing machine. A huge black and red cargo ship slid by on the horizon.
No, no boat today, the Syrian man who was working for the Turkish smugglers told them. Tomorrow.
But I was told it would be today, Mahmoud's father said. We hurried to get here today.
The smuggler raised a hand and shook his head.
No, no. You have money, yes? Tomorrow. You will get a text tomorrow.
But where are we supposed to go?
Mahmoud's mother asked the smuggler. Mahmoud couldn't believe it. They had spent 2 long days in cars and buses, trying to get here on time for the boat Dad had hired to take them across the sea to Greece. And now there was no boat.
There's a hotel on the next block, the smuggler said. They take Syrians.
We're trying to save money. We're going all the way to Germany, Dad told him.
There's a park nearby, the smuggler said.
A park? You mean sleep outside? But I have a baby, Mom said, gesturing to Hana in her arms.
The smuggler shrugged as if it didn't matter to him. His phone rang and he turned away to take it.
Tomorrow, he told Mahmoud's parents over his shoulder. You will get a text tomorrow. Be ready.
Mahmoud's father huffed, but immediately turned to his family and put on a smile.
Well, we always talked about taking a Mediterranean vacation, he said. We've got an extra night in Izmir. Who wants to go out dancing?
I just want to find some place dry where I can sleep, said Mom.
Dad led them in the direction of the hotel. All the shops were closing as they walked back through town, but Mahmoud marveled at how clean everything looked here in Turkey. There was no rubble, no twisted metal. The cobblestone streets were in perfect condition, and flowers grew in front of perfect little houses and shops. Shining cars and vans drove past on the road, and lights glowed in the windows of buildings.
Do you remember when it used to be like this in Syria? Mahmoud asked his little brother.
Walid was gawking just as much as Mahmoud, but he didn't say anything. Mahmoud took a deep, frustrated breath. He and Walid had had their fights. They were brothers, after all. But ever since Mahmoud could remember, Walid had been more like his best friend and constant companion. They played together, prayed together, shared a bedroom together. Walid had been the hyper one, bouncing off walls and hopping on furniture and kicking soccer balls in the hall. As annoying as his brother had been sometimes, Mahmoud wished he would show a little of the old crazy again. Not even the ninja turtle that Mahmoud had bought for him in Kilis had cheered Walid up. Later in the hotel lobby, Mahmoud was still thinking about how he could get his brother back when he heard the desk clerk say they had no rooms left.
Maybe someone will share with us, Mahmoud's father suggested to the clerk. You will forgive me, said the desk clerk, but the rooms already have 3 families apiece.
Mahmoud's heart sank. 3 families in each room! And the hotel was full! What were the chances they would find a room anywhere else? Dad searched on his phone and tried calling around, but it was the same story everywhere.
But how can they be so full?
Mahmoud's mother said. They can't all be leaving tomorrow. With nowhere else to go, they found the park the smuggler had told them about. But there was no room for them there either. All the other refugees who had been turned away from the hotels were there, some sleeping on benches in the rain, others lucky enough to have tents that looked like they had been there for more than a day or two. Mahmoud slumped in the rain. He was so wet, so tired. He just wanted somewhere warm and dry to sleep.
We should have stayed at the refugee camp, Mom said.
No, said his father, no, we move forward, always forward, and we don't stop until we get to Germany. We don't want to end up stuck in this place. Let's just see if we can find a dry spot for the night.
Mahmoud spied a thin Syrian boy about his age, approaching each of the families in the park, offering them something. Mahmoud wandered closer to have a look. The boy saw his interest and came over to him.
Want to buy some tissues? The boy asked.
He offered Mahmoud a small, unopened plastic pack of tissues. Just 10 Syrian pounds or 10 Turkish kurush.
No, thank you, Mahmoud said. Do you need water? Life vests? A phone charger?
I can get it for you, for a price.
We need a place to stay, Mahmoud said. The boy looked Mahmoud and his family over.
I know a place, the boy said. I will show you for 2,000 Syrian pounds, or 25 Turkish lira.
2,000 Syrian pounds was almost $10 American. A lot of money when you had a whole continent to cross. But the rain was getting stronger, and there was no place dry left in the park. When Mahmoud told his father the boy's offer, Dad was willing to pay. The boy led them away from the coast to a neighborhood where weeds grew up through the cobblestones and the houses had metal grates on the windows instead of flower boxes. One of the street lamps flickered, giving the street an ominous energy. The boy lifted a broken chain-link fence that led to a parking lot.
Here, he said.
Mahmoud's father gave the rest of his family a dubious look and led them under the fence. They followed the boy to a large square building with boarded-up windows and graffiti-covered walls. One of the boards blocking the door from trespassers had been ripped off, and they pushed their way inside. It was a mall. Or it had been once. A large open courtyard with an empty fountain in the middle was ringed with storefronts that went up for 4 levels. A few of the shops were lit up with lamps connected to extension cords, and others burned kerosene lamps and candles. But most of the shops weren't shops anymore. They were little apartments where people lived. Squatters in an abandoned shopping mall. The boy led them to an empty yogurt shop on the 3rd floor, next to a former music store that was home to a Syrian family of 6. They looked like they had been there a while. They had a tattered old couch and a hot plate, and sheets hung from ropes to quarter the space into little rooms. The yogurt shop had no furniture and a broken linoleum floor. Something skittered away in the darkness when they went inside.
It's just for the night, Mahmoud's father said.
You leave tomorrow? The boy said.
On a boat? Then you need life vests, most definitely, or else you drown when your boat flips.
Mahmoud's eyes went wide, and he shivered in his soaking wet clothes. He didn't like any part of this plan. His father raised his hands to his family.
The boat isn't going to flip, he told them.
Or run out of gas, or wreck on the rocks, the boy said. Then you drown.
Dad sighed.
All right, all right. Where do we buy life vests?
Joseph. Somewhere on the Atlantic Ocean, 1939. 11 days from home. Joseph's mother grabbed for his father's flailing arms, but Aaron Landau was too strong for her, thin as he was.
No, no! They're coming for us, he said, his eyes frantic. The ship is slowing down. Can't you feel it? We're slowing so they can turn us around, take us back to Germany.
Joseph's father pulled his arm away and knocked over a lamp. It fell to the floor with a crash, and the light went out.
Joseph, help me, his mother begged.
Joseph pulled himself away from the wall and tried to grab one of his father's arms while his mother went for the other. In the corner of her bed, Ruthie buried her face in Bitsy's ears and cried.
No! Joseph's father cried. We have to hide! Do you hear me? We can't stay here. We have to get off this ship!
Joseph grabbed his father's arm and held on tight.
No, Papa, we're not turning around, Joseph said. We're slowing for a funeral. A funeral at sea.
Joseph's father stopped dead, but Joseph kept a tight hold on him. He hadn't wanted to tell his father about the funeral, but now it seemed the only way to calm him down. Aaron Landau's bulging, haunted eyes swept to his son.
A funeral? Who's died? A passenger? It was the Nazis who did it. I knew they were on board. They're after us all.
He began to thrash again, more panicked than before.
No, Papa, no,
Joseph said. He fought to hold on to his father.
It was an old man, Professor Weiler. He was sick when he came aboard. It's not the Nazis, Papa.
Joseph knew all about it. Ruthie had begged him to go swimming in the pool with her and Renata and Evelina that afternoon. But Joseph was a man now, not a boy. He was too old for kids' stuff. He'd been walking the outside boardwalk on B-deck instead, keeping an eye out for the man from the engine room, Sheendick, and his friends, when he'd heard a cry from one of the cabin portholes. Peeking inside, he saw a woman with long, curly black hair and a white dress, sobbing as she lay across the body of an old man. Captain Schroeder and the ship's doctor were there, too. The man in the bed was perfectly still, his mouth open and his eyes staring blankly at the ceiling. He was dead. Joseph had never seen a dead body so close up before.
You there, boy!
Joseph had jumped. A woman walking her little dog on the boardwalk on B-deck had caught him peeping. He had sprinted away as the little dog barked at him, but not before Joseph heard the ship's doctor say that Professor Weiler had died of cancer. In his family's cabin now, a few hours later, Joseph still clung to his father's arm, trying to calm him down.
He was an old man, and he'd been sick for a long time already, Joseph told his father. They're burying him at sea because we're too far away from Cuba.
Joseph and his mother hung on to his father until Joseph's words finally got through. Papa stopped struggling against them and sagged, and suddenly they were holding him up off the floor.
He was sick already? Papa asked.
Yes, it was the cancer, Joseph said.
Joseph's father let them guide him to his bed, where he sat down. Mama went to Ruthie to comfort her.
When is the funeral? Papa asked.
Late tonight, Joseph told him.
I want to go, his father said.
Joseph couldn't believe it. Papa hadn't left the cabin in 11 days, and now he wanted to go to the funeral of someone he'd never met? In his condition? Joseph looked worriedly to his mother, who held Ruthie in her lap.
I don't think that's such a good idea, Mama said, echoing Joseph's thoughts.
I saw too many men die without funerals at Dachau, Papa said. I will go to this one.
It was the first time his father had even spoken the name of the place he'd been, and it was like a winter frost covered everything in the room. It ended the conversation as quickly as it had begun.
Take Joseph with you, then, Mama said. Ruthie and I will stay here.
That night, Joseph led his father to A-deck aft, where the captain and his first officer waited with a few other passengers. The passengers' clothes looked shabby, and it was only when he heard his father tearing his shirt that Joseph understood. Ripping your garments was a Jewish tradition at funerals, and they had torn theirs in sympathy with Mrs. Weiler. Joseph pulled on his own collar until the seam ripped. His father nodded, then led him to the sandbox by the pool and had him take a handful of sand. Joseph didn't understand, but he did as he was told. The elevator to A-deck arrived, and Mrs. Weiler emerged first, a candle in hand. Behind her came the rabbi and four sailors who carried Professor Weiler's body on a stretcher. He was bound up tight in a white sailcloth like an Egyptian pharaoh.
Hold on there.
The man from below decks, Sheendick, pushed through the small crowd with two fellow crew members.
I'm Otto Sheendick, the Nazi party leader on this ship, he said,
and German law says that a body buried at sea must be covered with the national flag."
Schiendick unfurled the red and white Nazi flag with the black swastika in the middle, and the passengers gasped. Papa pushed his way forward.
"Never! Do you hear me? Never! It's a sacrilege!"
He was shaking worse than ever. Joseph had never seen his father this angry, and he was frightened for him. Schiendick wasn't the kind of man you wanted to mess with. Joseph grabbed his father's arm and tried to pull him away. Papa spat at the feet of Schiendick.
"That is what I think of you and your flag."
Schiendick and his men surged forward to avenge the insult, but Captain Schroeder quickly intervened.
"Stop this! Stop this at once! Steward!" Captain Schroeder commanded.
Schiendick addressed his captain, but never took his eyes off Joseph's father.
"It's German law, and I see no reason for an exception to be made in this case."
"And I do," Captain Schroeder said. "Now, take that flag and leave here, Mr. Schiendick, or I will relieve you of duty and have you confined to quarters."
The steward held Papa's gaze a long moment more. His eyes shifted to Joseph, giving him goosebumps, and then Schiendick turned and stormed away. Joseph's chest heaved like he'd been running a marathon. He was so wound up he was quivering worse than his father. Sand slipped from his shaking fist. The captain apologized profusely for the disturbance, and the funeral continued. The rabbi said a short prayer in Hebrew, and the sailors slid the body of Professor Weiler over the side of the ship. After a moment, there was a quiet splash, and the mourners said together, "Remember, God, that we are of dust." One by one, they stepped to the rail, where they released handfuls of sand, the sand Joseph's father had told him to take from the sandbox. Joseph joined his father at the rail, and they scattered their sand in the sea. Captain Schroeder and his first officer put their caps back on and saluted. They touched the brims of their hats, Joseph noticed, instead of giving the Hitler salute. Without words, the funeral service broke up. Joseph expected his father to return to their cabin right away, but instead he lingered at the rail, staring down into the dark waters of the Atlantic. "What is he thinking?" Joseph wondered. "What happened to him at Dachau that he's now a ghost of the man he once was?"
"At least he didn't have to be buried in the hell of the Third Reich," his father said.
The ship rumbled softly, and Joseph knew the captain had restarted the engines. They were on their way to Cuba again. But how much time had they lost?
Isabel. The Straits of Florida, somewhere north of Cuba, 1994. One day from home. The tanker emerged from the darkness like some giant leviathan come to swallow them. It stood at least 7 stories tall out of the water and was so wide it filled the horizon. Its pointed bow sent huge waves sluicing away, and 2 massive anchors stood out from the sides like the horns on a monster. Isabel quailed in fear. It was straight out of a nightmare.
"A ship!" Lito yelled. "We've drifted into the shipping lanes!"
But by now, everyone had seen it. The rumble of the ship's massive engines had awakened Mommy and Senora Castillo, and everyone was scrambling around in the boat in a panic, making it rock dangerously.
"It's coming right for us!" Amara screamed.
Isabel climbed over Ivan, trying to get as far away from the tanker as she could. She slipped and fell with a splash into the bottom of the boat.
"Everybody settle down!"
Señor Castillo cried, but no one was listening.
"We have to get the engine started!"
Papi cried. He yanked frantically on the starter chain, barely giving the engine time to cough and die before he yanked on it again.
"Don't! You'll flood it and it'll never start,"
Luis said, trying to wrestle the chain from him.
"Where are the matches?"
Lito cried.
"We have to start a fire. They can't see us in the dark."
"Here," said Ivan.
He lifted a matchbox from the styrofoam carton that held the few emergency supplies they'd brought.
"No!"
Papi yelled. He lunged for Ivan's outstretched hand and together they fell against the side of the boat, tipping it. Isabel's mother fell into